Of all the Buddhist teachings, there are only two that he said are categorically true. In other words, there are only two that always meet his criteria for right speech. One is the Four Noble Truths. And the other is the teaching that skillful qualities, skillful actions should always be developed. Unskillful ones should always be abandoned. Now notice the three characteristics or the three perceptions are not mentioned there. That's because they don't always fit the Buddhist categories for right speech. They are true, as in that sutta we chanted just now. He said whether there's a Buddha or not a Buddha, these things are true. But holding them in mind is not always beneficial. It's not always timely. You have to figure out the right time and the right place. This is a point that has to be stressed over and over again, because over the centuries, especially in the commentaries, there developed a view that the Buddha's teaching on not-self meant there is no self, and that was his distinctive teaching. Even though when you look in the canon, he again and again refuses to answer the question of whether or not there is a self. And he says, if you say there is no self, that's siding with annihilationism. If you say there is a self, that's siding with eternalism. That's a question the Buddha would always put aside. And yet they developed a view that when the Buddha says all dhammas are not self, it means there is no self. But you think about lots of times when that teaching would be extremely detrimental. Like if someone's feeling tempted to do something really unskillful, they can tell themselves, well, there is no self, there's nobody to reap the rewards of this, so it doesn't really matter, even if the results are bad. In fact, there was actually a monk in the time of the Buddha who tried to think, and all he did was just think in that way. The Buddha reprimanded him. But there are other times, like a mother loses a child, and if you tell her, well, there was really no child there to begin with, she'll bash you over the head. So when do you use these teachings? One, remember that these are not characteristics of things so much as they are perceptions. When do you apply these perceptions? And it's good to think back in terms of those categorical teachings, especially ones on the Four Noble Truths, because each of the Four Noble Truths entails a duty. And it's in fulfilling the duties for the Four Noble Truths that you pull out these perceptions when they're appropriate. For example, with suffering or stress, the First Noble Truth. The duty is to comprehend it. And comprehending here means understanding it to the point of dispassion. So first you've got to figure out where in your life you're clinging to the aggregates, because that's the Buddha's definition, or his succinct statement about the First Noble Truth. Where are you clinging to the aggregates, and to what extent is it causing you suffering? Okay. That's when you start looking at the things you're clinging to and ask yourself, is this something constant or inconstant? Stressful? Well, if it's inconstant, it's going to be stressful if you hang on to it. And then the third question, is it worth holding on to itself? In other words, is it worth going through all that trouble to claim that this is you or yours? So that's the application for those perceptions with regard to the First Noble Truth. This is really good when you're sick, and the body's unwell, when there are obvious ways the mind is making itself suffer. You can ask yourself, this thing that I'm holding on to, this thought, this idea, this object I'm holding on to, is it really worth clinging to? And then let it go. Either by just seeing it's not self, or not worthy of holding on to self as self. Or sometimes just seeing that holding on to is stressful, you let it go. The same applies to the Second Noble Truth. When there's craving, you see that you're suffering from the craving. You say, why do I bother wanting that? Do I really need that thing that I'm craving? And the three kinds of craving that Buddha points to is craving for sensuality, those stories we tell ourselves about how great something's going to be or how great something was. A sight, sound, smell, taste, tactile sensation. Our fascination with all those stories. Where does it get us? In the John Lee's image, he says, thinking about pleasures for tomorrow is like licking tomorrow's soup pot when there's no soup in it yet. Thinking about the pleasures of yesterday is like licking yesterday's soup pot and soup is all gone. There's no real nourishment there. So again, you can use the three characteristics or the three perceptions there. With regard to the third noble truth, this is when you use them as a test. When you found something really good in your meditation and you're inclined to think, oh, this must be it, ask yourself, is there any inconstancy here? John Mahabua talks about this in the stages in the meditation where the mind gets extremely bright. And it's utterly amazing. And it's very easy at that point to conclude, okay, this must be it. And some people don't even get that far. They get to other stages where, say, everything just seems one, and you've heard someplace that this is all about oneness. So you cling to that. Or even just the equanimity that you can develop. As you see that things are arising and passing away, there's a certain equanimity that comes from that, and you latch on to that. You have to ask yourself, okay, is this constant? Does this really meet with all the criteria? Because nirvana is not inconstant and it's not stressful. And begin to realize that even in those states, there's a little bit of wavering, there's a little bit of uncertainty, a little bit of instability. And that right there is an element of stress. So you say, okay, this hasn't passed the test. Even when you do run into the unfabricated, this is where the teaching on sabbes tamma anatta, all phenomena are not self. That means not just fabricated stuff, but unfabricated things. There tends to be an attachment where you say, oh, this must be it, this is it, I got it. And there's a little bit of I in there. There's a passage where the Buddha says, when someone talks about how I am unbound, I have attained the awakening. He says, just the fact that he says I indicates there's something still in there. The mind's proper reaction to those things is, there is this. There is the cessation of fabrication. There is the cessation of suffering. You've pared things down to the kind of narratives you tell yourself to the point where you can just say, well, there's just this, there's just that, without getting the I involved in there. And that's the proper way of noting these things, because then the mind is not clinging to anything at all, and that last vestige of clinging is gone. And that's when it is possible to gain total freedom. As for the fourth noble truth, especially when you're doing concentration right here, you do not want to be telling yourself, the breath is inconstant, the mind's concentration is inconstant, I've gained an insight, well, what's next? That short circuits everything right there. If you're going to apply the three perceptions to anything, you apply them to your distractions right now. Greed comes up, anger comes up, sensual desire, ill will, sleepiness, sloth and torpor, restlessness and anxiety, doubt. Just tell yourself, okay, these things are inconstant. They come and they go. Why believe them? Why put the energy into them to keep following them? First, recognize that they are hindrances. That right there is an accomplishment, because sometimes anger comes up and we can tell ourselves, that person I'm angry at really deserves my anger, or the thing you're desiring really is desirable. Or you get sleepy. So I really got to go to sleep. In other words, you side with the thing. You don't see it as a hindrance. You see it as a friend. So first you got to see it. One, this is a hindrance. And then two, why do I engage in it? What does it have to offer? And then you can let it go. But as for the breath and as for your state of concentration, you don't want to be contemplating how inconstant those things are. You're actually trying to push against the principle of inconstancy and stress and not self. You're trying to make this thing last, this concentration. You're trying to make it pleasant. You're trying to get it under your control, because that's what the whole notion of not self is. And as the Buddha said, it's not that everything is, all the aggregates are always painful or always uncontrollable. On the ultimate level, there's stress. On the ultimate level, there is a lack of control. But in the meantime, you can get some use out of these things. Because after all, what is your concentration made up out of? It's made out of those aggregates, but in a very subtle form. And for the time being, those aggregates you don't apply these three perceptions to. You've got something, you want to protect it. You don't just throw it away. And John Lee says most of us are, especially people who like to run right to inconstancy, stress, and not self right away. He says they're like people who let go when they don't have anything to begin with. And let go like paupers. It's like not having a Cadillac and saying, okay, I'm going to let go of my Cadillac. We don't have a Cadillac. And when there's no Cadillac, okay, you haven't gotten to the trouble of getting a Cadillac to begin with, and when you let go of it, nobody else can gain any benefit from it. Because one of the things about these things is you ultimately let go, like the concentration, ultimately you will turn around and apply the perceptions of inconstancy, stress, and not self to them. But that doesn't mean you don't have concentration anymore. You go beyond it, but then you come back and you can use it. It's a tool still. And the same way with the Cadillac. You go to the trouble. It's a good car, buy it. As far as I know, Cadillacs are okay. And then once you have it and you let go of it, okay, there it is for everybody to use. You can still use it. Other people can use it. In other words, you still gain benefit from these things. When the Buddha gained awakening, he didn't lose his ability to enter into concentration. He didn't lose the things that he'd let go of. He let go of the clinging. But the good things were still there for him to use. So it's the same here. You have to work on the concentration. And only when you've got it really solid and it's done its work on the mind, calm the mind, soothe the mind, nourish the mind, give it a good place to stand so it can watch things clearly, then you start applying those perceptions of inconstancy, stress, not self, to the aggregates that make up the concentration, the form of the body and the concentration, the breath, the feeling of pleasure, the perception that holds you with the breath, the thought fabrications, verbal fabrications, evaluating things, and even the consciousness of the concentration. You start seeing, well, yeah, this too is inconstant. There is in some subtle inconstancy here. Then you look for something that's not inconstant. There's still some stress in here. You look for something that's not going to change on you, that doesn't have that stress of change. You realize this too is something worth not identifying with. And if you handle that contemplation well, okay, then the mind opens up to that other dimension where there is just this, the dimension of the deathless. When you return from that, okay, the concentration is still there. You can still do it. All the things you developed on the path are still there for you to use. But you can pick them up, put them down. They don't weigh you down. You don't have to carry them around. They're there. So make sure that you use these teachings at the proper time, at the proper place. And that's when they're beneficial. But it's all within the context, say, of the Four Noble Truths or the question of what's skillful and what's not skillful. Those are the teachings that are always true, always applicable, always beneficial, always timely. If you start dealing with thoughts and perceptions that are not beneficial, even though they may be true, you can get the mind all screwed up. You could start thinking about how the sun someday is going to go nova, it's going to explode, and the earth will be just burnt to a crisp and then just disappear. And that's true, as far as we know. But how helpful is that for you right now? It can actually get you discouraged from doing good things if you think about it in the wrong way. So remember to take as your framework the Buddha's categorical truths, the ones that are always true, always beneficial, always timely. Always make that your framework. And as for his other teachings, you have to figure out, okay, when are they beneficial, when are they timely? Using that larger framework as your standard of judgment. And that's how you grasp the teachings rightly. Remember the Buddha said this, his teachings are like a snake. If you grasp the snake wrongly, it's going to bite you. If you grasp the snake by the tail, it's going to turn around. It's got teeth on the other end. It'll bite you. If you grasp it rightly, put a fork over its head, okay, then you can get your use out of the snake. But notice, you still grasp it. If you don't grasp the snake at all, you don't get any benefit from it at all. The question is, how do you grasp it well? Knowing about that is part of the skill of right view. Knowing how to do it is how you perform the duties appropriate for all the noble truths. And that's when you get the benefit out of the Buddha's teachings. And the Buddha's teachings are all about that benefit. The fact that he presents his teachings as a path means they're all about where the path goes. They're means to an end. The path has its fruit, or as another way the Buddha says it, the Dhamma has its atta, which means goal, benefit, and also meaning. It's in getting to that freedom from suffering. That's where the meaning of all this lies. This is when you really know what the teachings mean. And the path has done its work. So everything else is a means. We're here in the present moment, not because the present moment is a good place to stay, but we're learning how to use the present moment as a means to something higher. So remember, this applies to all the Buddhist teachings. They're means. So it's up to us to figure out how to use them correctly so we can gain the goal at which they're all aimed at.